And good evening. My name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to be joined on this broadcast by Harry Martin, the editor of the Napa Sentinel and also the North American Investigative Journal, and currently sitting on the Napa City Council and possibly, depending on some still up-in-the-air election results, the Napa County Board of Supervisors. Harry, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, David.
There's been a lot of publicity in recent weeks and months concerning a San Jose Mercury News series. And, of course, for the benefit of people who are listening to this program on tape, the San Jose Mercury News is distributed right here in the South San Francisco Bay Area, the much-ballyhooed Silicon Valley from which my broadcast originates. And there was a series called Dark Alliance by an investigative reporter named Gary Webb. And it discussed connections between the intelligence community, specifically the intelligence community elements associated with the Contra War, such as the CIA, and the crack cocaine epidemic, which began to afflict American cities in the 1980s. It specifically talks about some connections between the intelligence community and the Contra War and the cocaine trade right here in the Bay Area. This subject has occasioned a lot of debate. And for longtime listeners to this program, that subject had a familiar ring, the intelligence community and the drug trade, and specifically connections between the cocaine trade and the Contra War and the intelligence community is something that I've spoken about for a long time. And you, Harry, broke a story in the 1980s that I have accessed on this broadcast for many years concerning some connections between, once again, the intelligence community, the Contra War, the drug trade, and efforts on the part of the Nixon, the Reagan and Bush administrations against the Sandinistas. And this preceded the San Jose Mercury News series by many years. And that is the Drug Tug case. And if I should forget, Harry, at the end of the interview, remind me to remind the listeners about where they can access your series about the drug trade, about the Drug Tug case. Now, in reviewing the Drug Tug case, it might be interesting to start with some of your history as a publisher in the defense publication trade, because ultimately that led to some contacts that were to result in your landmark Drug Tug case series. Could you briefly outline some of your history of in the publishing business, specifically in the defense-related publishing industry?
Well, excuse me, I've been in publishing for 30 years. In about 3 months, it'll be 30 years. And all along the Pacific Rim and Alaska, Hawaii, California, Australia. And for many years, for almost 5 years, I was in the publishing business for defense publications in which the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Eugene Tai, Bobby Enman, who was the deputy CIA and who was head of NSA, we had the head of Marine Intelligence, we had Naval Intelligence. As these people retired, we went on our staff, including the Mossad, and we had offices all around the world in military publications, and we were probably one of the most quoted publications in the Pentagon. It was a very popular publication with Congress and the defense industry and also foreign governments. And so our contacts are still around.
Now, the Drug Tug case first came to your attention as the result of some people with connections to the intelligence community who apparently were disenchanted with some other factions in the intelligence community. Perhaps as a preamble, so to speak, to an actual delineation of the Drug Tug case, you might want to talk about some of the conflicts that were taking place as George Bush became president between some factions of the intelligence community. And specifically here, I'm thinking about events related to the death of Colonel Higgins, a Marine Corps colonel, and how that stirred the ire of some people who ultimately were instrumental in breaking the story to you.
Well, first of all, the Drug Tug itself broke its own news in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1988 when 45 tons of marijuana hashish were brought in by barge into the San Francisco Bay Area, and the crew was all arrested, and the crew came from Napa, and that's how we first got involved. And then, of course, it's the fingers touched many things, including a mortgage company, which was seized, and the assets were seized, and then they brought in bankruptcy people who, in turn, ended up in prison for embezzling millions of dollars, and it just began to create all types of things. And as we were investigating the drug tug captain, who has two life sentences right now, and he still corresponds with us, Calvin Robinson, was Boyce's cellmate in California when Boyce was the choir boy who, in other words, he was a CIA operative who sold the CIA secret satellite information to the Soviets. And, in fact, he helped them in this escape. He hid them. And as we went further and further through the investigation, we began to tie other things. We started to work with the Christic Institute, and we had people down in Costa Rica that were working with us, that and people that owned the island where the drugs were being transferred were from Napa and so forth. And then, of course, our sources on the intelligence side were very up. When you bring in Colonel Higgins, Colonel Higgins was allowed to be tortured and murdered in Lebanon, and the military was extremely upset with the Bush administration for allowing this to happen. And they began to leak out a lot more information than they normally had done so.
It's my recollection that the ire on the behalf of some of the contacts who, and again, the drug tug we're going to talk about specifically, came to light when it was a huge, huge bust in San Francisco Bay in May of 1988 that you've already alluded to. But some of the myriad intelligence connections to this case, as I recollect, were disclosed to you by people with connections to the intelligence community who were upset over Colonel Higgins going down. Could you maybe explain a little bit more about what Colonel Higgins was doing to the extent that you can on the air and why this led them to disclose some of this information?
Well, Colonel Higgins was in Lebanon, and he was kidnapped. He had knowledge of the drug trade and everything else, and the military, supposedly died of a heart attack after getting electrical shocks constantly and so forth. The military could have gotten them out of there, or the intelligence community, and they weren't allowed to. He had tremendous knowledge of the drug trade and the arms trade that went to Iran and so forth, and he was allowed to perish, and it just hired these people so much that they began to unload information dealing with later on became Iran-Contra.
We should note here that one of the things that looms in the background of the drug tug case as a strategic and journalistic element concerns basically conflicts, something we've spoken about before on the air, conflicts within various factions of the national security establishment.
Well, as we have talked before, the military is not does not agree with the civilian intelligence. As you know, the CIA was formed out of the Office of
Strategic Services.
Strategic Services, they had that was after the war. But the Office of Naval Intelligence has been really the prime intelligence gatherer for 200 years in this country, and they resented it as well, the civilian control, and consequently, there's been some very major battles between the two elements, and both sides have lost periodically, and from the other sort of leaking out information of what's going on.
Going to the drug tug case per se, and we're actually going to get into the Intrepid Venture, the actual name of the vessel that has been dubbed the drug tug, and some of the particulars of the case. One of the central figures in this tangled web, and a very tangled web it is a mysterious and now deceased financier named Kenneth Armitage. Could you tell us a little more about him?
Well, Kenneth Armitage was connected throughout the world, and particularly with the intelligence agency, as a mover within the drug community, the triangle in Asia and so forth. And he was sort of the mover and the shaker in those areas. And he was involved in the getting of the drug tug, the island where the drugs were being smuggled from. And his people forced a person from Napa who had owned it. They were forced, threatened. In other words, they had somebody drive up in a limousine, throw water in the face and said it could have been acid, and that they were intimidated so much that they went down to the Costa Rican, not the embassy, but the mission down in San Francisco and signed off the island for no charge.
That was a fellow named Johnny Beck, correct?
Johnny Beck.
One of the things that you mentioned in your series, and again, at the end of this, we're going to tell people where they can get a hold of your landmark Drug Tug series, was that this island, the Isla Jesucito, or the Drug Island, as it has been dubbed, was owned by a revolving series of figures in Napa, including Kenneth Armitage. Could you tell us a little more about the mysterious and apparently revolving ownership of the Isla Jesucito?
Well, the island was originally used for gold smuggling by these people in Napa. In fact, one of the persons is now currently in jail. The other person is not. And they own the island, and they had a habit of trading real estate for other real estate. Not that they necessarily knew who those, I mean, in other words, not necessarily, they didn't always own what they were trading. And this went on and on. But the two Napans that had owned the island were very close to the president of Costa Rica, and they were doing a lot of activities there. They were going to build a hotel there and with their gold smuggling. And then it was transferred to Johnny Beck, and Johnny Beck, in turn, had a boat problem. He brought it in for repairs, and the next thing you know, the Armitage people were after him. They needed that island. It's very strategic. And so they basically threatened until they got that island. Now, strangely enough, it's back in the hands of the two Napans that originally owned it, that were friends with the president.
So it is revolved, and again, in a sense, it has already come full circle. Now, this island, the Isla Jesucita, and we're going to get into the whole issue of the bankruptcy courts and some of the revolving properties. The Isla Jesucita was actually owned, you mentioned in your series, by a Panamanian corporation, and behind that was under the control of former Panamanian dictator Noriega.
Right, and Ken Armitage worked very, very closely with Noriega. Noriega, of course, worked very closely with George Bush, the CIA, and that whole drug contra movement.
Kenneth Armitage at one point was in custody and threatening to roll over, and his case had sort of an interesting, although not atypical, disposition in these kinds of investigations.
That custody was in England, too. It wasn't in the United States.
And how did obviously this is a dead giveaway, no pun intended. How did Mr. Armitage end up? Not again an unusual fate for a lot of people that have come under investigation with these in connection with these types of activities. Now, how specifically did the Isla Jesucita or Drug Island fit in with people like Dictator Noriega and also people like John Hull, one of the central figures in the Christic investigation?
Well, John Hull, of course, had a huge ranch in Costa Rica, and that ranch was used for the exchange of drugs for arms to supply the Contras in Nicaragua. And, of course, the island was a great shipping point because it was south of where the Coast Guard and naval installations were, and it's very hard to see it and patrol it. And, therefore, it was just a very good access, and it had access directly to the ocean.
You mentioned that the island was a central element in the Contra support effort.
As was Hall's Ranch, yes.
We should note, too, that the Christic investigation, which focused centrally on John Hull, has received, well, basically has been widely dissed by both the so-called established press as well as elements of the alternative press. And yet, in your series, you point out that much of the damaging information, or many of the most damaging allegations about people like John Hull, Oliver North, Rob Owen, came actually from a Costa Rican government investigation.
Absolutely. In fact, there was an arrest warrant out for John Hull in the United States, including Bush's vice president, who was a senator at the time, and many senators, including the congressman that represented Napa County, all sent letters to the president and also to Costa Rica saying we do not want him extradited. Also, in his diaries are meetings of him, Quayle, and Ollie North many, many times dealing with the Contra situation. And they're right in fact, they were in Ollie North's diaries. the meeting with Hall and so forth.
We should note again that there was official U.S. government pressure, or actually maybe we shouldn't call it official, since I don't think it ever actually...
Well, no, these were congressmen and senators. I'd call it official.
Yeah, now, one of the things, was there ever any actual pressure, say, by the State Department or CIA or any of the government agencies per se, or were these individuals sort of acting, quote, on their own, unquote?
No, they addressed it. These congressmen and senators signed letters specifically addressed to the government. The government, Costa Rican government, also had an arrest warrant out for the head of the CIA mission who was kicked out of the country. And Hall was not extradited back. They said he didn't have the help to stand it and everything else. And just simply his, you know, he had such a powerful base that, Congress and senators mainly dealing with the foreign area would not allow his extradition.
We should note, too, that the wording of that letter was very interesting. They sort of indicated, again, including Congressman Bosco from the Napa District, they told the president of Costa Rica that they thought it would be very unfortunate if anything came up that would interfere with U.S.-Costa Rican relations. It was a pretty interestingly worded letter.
And that's the pressure you're talking about. In other words, simply the U.S. government says, no, what can Costa Rica do about it?
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, and perhaps before we get into the whole issue of the passports and then on to the drug tug and the myriad of financial institutions in Napa that figure in the background, what exactly was going on the drug island in terms of guns and drugs?
Well, it was just basically a turnover. As I say, most of the turnover was at John Hall's ranch. The drug island was originally used for gold smuggling, but then it started to pick up arms shipments. And those, in other words, in exchange for the drugs, and then the arms shipments went to Hall's ranch, and then they went into Nicaragua. Because as you remember now, Congress had forbidden the United States government to supply the Contras with any weapons. And therefore, the clandestine operation took place in which we would trade drugs for arms, and then those arms would be shipped. It was the same as Iran-Contra, where they were sending arms to Iran illegally.
One of the things you mentioned in connection with the imbroglio surrounding the drug tug was an interesting passport scheme that Mr. Armitage was running. How does this fit into the picture?
And Johnny Beck got stuck in it, if you remember.
Right.
In fact, two Napans got stuck in it. Basically, passports could be issued. Diplomatic passports were issued in anybody's name that wanted them, and you had to pay, it was $50,000, I believe, for the various passports. And, of course, it would give you, with an international passport, you can go buy customs without ever having to show anything. Your suitcases are inviolate, and you know, nobody can touch you with an international with a diplomatic passport. And so he was issuing those through the Panamanian and through the Costa Rican government. And in fact, Mr. Beck and another person were buying these from Mexican sources, and then they had a big scam on that thing, and they both had to flee from Mexico and come back to Napa.
Moving to the drug tug itself, now there was a tugboat called the Intrepid Venture that was being piloted, as you mentioned, by the aforementioned Calvin Robinson. It was busted in May of 1988 with a huge shipment of Thai marijuana and hashish, tons and tons worth. How does this tie in with the drug island?
Well, first of all, the whole operation was tied in. It was this these drugs came from the Seattle area, and the CIA agents were the ones that actually set it up. But then somebody blew the whistle to the customs, which doesn't necessarily work with the CIA, and that's how the drug tug went down. But it was a normal shipment that would come in. That shipment would come down from Seattle, and then it would be flown down to probably either to Hall's Ranch or to the drug island, and then they're distributed in exchange for weapons.
One of the things you mentioned that was that apparently, at least according to what Calvin Robinson said, there was apparent complicity by some elements of the DEA in some of these operations.
Well, absolutely, because you see, he was contacted by an agent to do this thing. Now, one of the things testified, not just by him, but by all the other members of the crew, and the other members of the crew were acquitted, by the way, was the fact that they never actually got on the barge. and the barge was loaded and it was sealed up, and they had people working on it, and they never, the crew of the drug tug never actually saw the content of the barge. It was totally sealed, and they never had any access to it. They just towed it, and under international law, because it's towed, they can't be held responsible for that cargo, but they were held. And remember now, when Calvin Robinson went to court, the day that his trial was to start, the night before his trial was to start, his attorney was shot to death in Oakland, and the judge would not allow Robinson to get another attorney and insisted the trial proceed.
How exactly was the judge able to pull something like that off? Again, I'm not a legal professional. That seems highly questionable.
I have no idea, but the thing is, it ended up Calvin representing himself, and all the other people who were represented by attorneys were acquitted, and he was convicted, and he appealed his decision, and they threw the judgment out, I mean the sentencing out, and gave it back to the same judge to do the sentencing again. And I don't know how it could happen. It just did happen. I mean, this was a public record. It's not a conspiracy theory. It just actually happened.
Normally,
you would postpone a trial for 30 or 60 days to allow new counsel to come in.
Yeah, that's a...
You would insist on it, actually, as a judge. But Vicoffin had a very strange reputation for things like this in the past.
And he's no longer with us, correct?
He died off.
One of the things that you point out in a number of your investigative series is the number of deaths that took place when some of these things have come under investigation. It certainly, one would not want to be an insurance agent writing a policy for someone involved in some of these covert operations.
Well, we got several death threats, and in fact, the DEA came in, and local law enforcement insisted I wear a bulletproof vest, and I had to take phone calls from a phone booth lying on the ground as informants came in and gave calls. We had to tape the calls, and then I never ran the tapes myself. I just handed them to the DEA. And so they were in my office and the FBI on a constant basis over this thing, and they're very concerned with our security.
One of the people that you mentioned in connection with the structure around Calvin Robinson is a figure named William Doherty, who apparently had worked as a CIA contract agent. First of all, maybe before we get into the subject of Doherty per se, the term CIA contract agent is one that is widely misunderstood. A lot of people think that refers to an assassin. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, no. And what happens is you may not be a member of the CIA itself, but they will contract you out. For instance, the Brennecke, for instance, was a contract. Now, he was one who was involved with the October Surprise thing. He was contract pilot. A lot of people get a contract to work for them and to do certain things, but they are not particularly CIA agents themselves.
Going to the subject of William Doherty per se, could you tell us a little bit about his relationship with Calvin Robinson and Dredgemaster Associates?
Well, basically, he was involved in as an attorney, but representing the people, and also was involved in the shareholding and so forth. And Calvin got into a real big hassle, as did the Dredgemasters, with the Corps of Engineers, not because they hadn't been paid for certain contractual work. And the next thing you know, Doherty is ending up selling materials. But what we found there was we found Bank of America notes arranged by him from a Texas Bank of America branch that provided millions of dollars, and the only security was one tugboat, which was worth far less than that. And there's just a lot of manipulation, and there's been suits between Dredgemaster and Doherty ever since.
One of the things that you mentioned in connection with, one of the figures, I should say, that you mentioned in connection with the drug tug case is a fellow named John Duff, a Napa area gynecologist.
Okay, well, John Duff was, the IRS was after him, and he was a doctor, and he got down to Costa Rica. See, there's a lot of Napa connections to Costa Rica, just tons of people. And he was down in Costa Rica running medical aid and so forth, but he was also tied into all this passports and gun running and so forth as well.
One of the things that you mentioned in connection with the drug tug case And you began with it in the very first of your series from August 4th of 1989. And then it crops up in later articles, and the connections begin to develop in a truly Byzantine way. And we're going to take this up at greater length in the second half of this interview. But you mentioned that the financing and the revolving ownership of the island took place through some curious manipulation of various bankruptcy properties. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And we're going to go into this at greater length in the second half of the interview.
Well, that's where I was telling you, where these guys would do trade-offs. In other words, they come and say, I'll trade you this house in exchange for this. In other words, for instance, these guys traded a house for a limousine service. And they also traded a house, a limousine service for a castle in a castle hotel in England. Well, on both sides of the picture, the people involved, the people who were trading and the people who were trying to, you know, hone the onto it, they were trading things that had liens on them or had been bankrupt or didn't even have ownership rights. So they have dealt with this all the way from I forgot the name, it's something Star Hotel in Texas, to a great big medical building in Napa. All over the country, these things have been traded, and in fact, that's why one of them is in jail today.
Well, not being a mover and shaker and a wheeler and a dealer, one of the things that raises questions in my mind about these transactions is, would they not have had to pay taxes on these things?
No, that's why the IRS was chasing them.
Okay, all right, well, that explains that. It just seems strange.
I had to get the DEA to give a little bit of forgiveness to one of the people because he had valuable information on that whole drug traffic. In fact, several Napans flew to Thailand where the origination of the drugs came from. So, it's a sea of problems. And, of course, at the same time the drug tug was going out from Hawaii, they had sent out several other ones as well. And I forgot, it's in the series, what the other name of one of them was that was captured. But in other words, there was a mothership involved.
Was that the Survey 1 and Survey 2?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.